Yeah, that's a really powerful question.
That's a beautiful question.
That is a very wise question, Lauren.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with Callan Wink, author of the novel Beartooth, the story of Thad and Hazen, two brothers who live in Montana's Absaroka Beartooth Wilderness, nearly off-grid at the edge of Yellowstone National Park. Grieving the death of their father and struggling under the weight of his debt, Thad and Hazen resort to desperate measures to stay and survive on the familiar, though unforgiving, landscape. Callan, thank you so much for joining me to talk about Beartooth. Welcome back to The Right Question.
Well, thanks for having me.
We're talking about Beartooth today. This is a novel that takes place, as the title suggests, in and around the Beartooth Mountains of Montana, which are north of Yellowstone National Park. Tell me and our listeners a bit about this area. For those who have yet to read your book and really feel that place, or those who have never traveled to that area, give us a sense of where this story is taking place.
Yeah, so... You know, in writing it, I did play sort of fast and loose with specifics, and probably there's going to be like hardcore fans of Yellowstone Park who will read this and be like, well, that's not quite right. And yeah, that's part of it. But just in general, I mean, the Absaroka Beartooth Wilderness is it's an amazing stretch of mountains that runs. I believe the largest continuous wilderness area above 10,000 feet in the lower 48 states. So just extremely wild country. And living in Livingston for the last 20 years, been really blessed to live by that and recreate there quite a bit. I spend most of my time on the river, but you know, I do hike and run as much as I can up in the mountains. So yeah, I think the place itself does play a fairly large role in the story. The two characters are immersed in that world. So.
And it is so close to Yellowstone National Park. Is there like a pretty strict boundary between the wilderness areas where it's very remote, where there might not be a lot of people, and then the places where there might be a lot of tourists? Is there a pretty distinct boundary there?
I mean, it's interesting. I think if you're in Yellowstone Park and you're near a road, you know, it's congested, it's often busy, but if you're willing to hike a mile and a half off the road, you're in wilderness. I mean, the Yellowstone contains, I believe, the furthest you can get from a road in the lower 48 states. So, I mean, it's definitely out there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There are two brothers at this novel's center, Thad and Hazen. Am I pronouncing Hazen's name correctly?
Yeah.
Hazen.
Yep.
Introduce these brothers to our listeners. How would you characterize them?
Yeah. So they're close in age. Both of them, you know, have grown up in this. It's not, you know, quite like off the grid, but fairly close. I mean, more so than most people. And Thad is the older brother, kind of sort of taking over the kind of familial responsibilities after the death of their father. He feels like he needs to sort of keep an eye on Hazen, who's a little bit more of a wild card, doesn't exactly fit in with many of the constructs of normal society, I guess is how you'd say it. The dynamic between them is like, I think probably a lot of brotherly relationships, you know, contentious at times.
Yeah. The novel opens with a dead bear in the wake of their father's death. As you just said, the two brothers have resorted to poaching in order to supplement their small income of felling trees for firewood. And Callan, there are a couple different directions I want to take this particular question, but let's focus first on their life after their father's death. These brothers were kind of forced to care for their father in his final months and days. And Thad, because of him being the eldest, and maybe a little bit more, I don't know, insert adjective here, he ends up caring and taking care of Hazen too, kind of making sure that Hazen doesn't get into trouble, as he might be wont to do. I thought it was an interesting stroke, not only to spotlight caretaking in the way that you have in this novel, but to use a male character as the vehicle for it. How did you come to that decision?
You know, I honestly don't know if it was a conscious decision, but I did, you know, starting with the characters, I knew I wanted one, the older brother, to feel this responsibility after the passing of his father. And, you know, Hazen as a character changed quite a bit in the course of the writing. I think a little more sort of, a little more out there, for lack of a better term. And he kind of reined it back in. So I think towards the end, you know, you don't really know if Thad, like, the pressures he was feeling were warranted necessarily by Hazen's behavior all the time, or if it was something more within him that was like, had a hard time relinquishing control over his younger brother. So that dynamic was something I was interested in. Yeah,
and readers, I certainly did get the sense that Thad felt certainly this sense of responsibility that you just stated, and definitely this sense of control. You do get the sense that he has been used to sort of wielding that control over Hazen throughout their life. Another character in the book, a man called only the Scot, he's, I will say for our listeners' sake, he's the one that is paying the brothers to kill the bears in the book's first pages. He's sort of a dark, malicious figure in the book. He says, quote, "I've noticed a strange thing in those who serve as caretakers. They tend to underestimate the ability of their charges. The more someone needs your care, the more important your existence becomes." And he basically tells Thad, the Scot, tells Thad that if Hazen wasn't reliant on him, he wouldn't know what to do with himself, right? And in my reading, Callan, this idea doesn't necessarily drive the novel, but it does come back. We do see that idea kind of come back at the novel's conclusion. Can you talk a little bit about that and how you saw that idea sort of, again, maybe not driving the momentum of the novel's plot, but certainly living in Thad's character?
Yeah, I think with the Scot, you know, that was a line of dialogue where you're right, he is sort of a malicious figure, and he's kind of trying to play the brothers against each other to get what he wants from them. But it's, so I always enjoy in novels and movies and whatever, when a sort of the sort of villainous character does have the ability to sort of make kind of a penetrating insight that, that despite his, you know, villainous presence in the novel is causes the other characters to reconsider their own actions. I guess would make a character less sort of flat on the page, a villain anyway, if we're calling the Scot a villain, which he kind of is.
Yeah. Can we talk about this idea of villains? Because I think that's one thing that I was surprised to kind of be navigating or trying to kind of pinpoint in my own reading of the book. And I'll give a little background for listeners. So medical bills and liens on the brother's house have sort of overwhelmed them at this point, and they're really just trying to keep their heads above water financially. They turn to poaching, as I said briefly. They even consider illegally collecting antlers in Yellowstone. And I think Beartooth became, in these moments for me, something of a thought exercise around philosophical stalemates, right? So we have two men who are, as I just said, just trying to get by, but doing things that are severely looked down upon, not only by locals, but are illegal, right? Poaching or snagging antlers and sheds from the national park. These are like very much bad guy moves. And I'm curious about the conversation you hope to evoke here, whether you wanted your readers to kind of feel this ambiguity. Are readers being moved towards empathy where they, I don't know, in other circumstances involving other people, other characters might not be inclined to feel that empathy, but because we are so close to these brothers, we might be letting them off the hook a little bit? Tell me about that particular conversation that you had with yourself as you were writing and what you want your readers to be kind of questioning as they move through the plot.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing I did really want to sort of get on the page is this sort of sense of desperation that comes from financial difficulty. That it, you know, especially in Montana, at least the people I know in Montana over the years, you know, they live move there or were born there. They love living there for a reason, which is, you know, basically the wonderful natural resources, and they make sacrifices in order to continue to live there. And one of those is that, at least historically, you never made much money. And so, I think most people I know, myself included, at various times would be one sort of minor disaster away from like severe financial difficulty. And it can just sort of escalate quickly. And that's something I've been fairly familiar with in my life. And so, and it's something I don't necessarily see often in fiction, or I can't, nothing really comes to mind immediately right now, but it is something I wanted here, was that people definitely get driven to do things that are, you know, ethically questionable, you know, out of desperation. So
how much of Livingston's growth and growth in that particular area of Montana really drove the writing of this novel for you? Was that something that you really had in mind when you were building this world and certainly building these characters?
Yeah, it's definitely something in the back of my mind more and more as I'm writing these days, because the area is changing quite a bit. And I think that sense of community that sort of has arisen from the fact that people were, you know, drawn to Montana or continue to live there if they were born there because they wanted to fish or ski or hunt or climb or whatever. And the sacrifices you made to continue to do that has really gotten upended by sort of remote work. You can work your San Francisco tech job, you know, and live in Montana now. And so I think that sort of sense of like, we're all in this together, not making any money, but loving life is sort of fading, at least in Livingston, as far as I can tell. Not completely, but it's definitely changing a lot. So it's something I'm thinking about when I'm writing, for sure.
Yeah, and the moral or ethical compasses of the people that are living in these places seem a little bit more disjointed. I mean, there are other instances in Beartooth, I don't know, when we're seeing, again, this kind of philosophical stalemate. We're introduced to a man who's we're told he's a rich man. His house is built on an old burial site, and he collects in his basement a number of artifacts found in the area. And we're introduced to him. And I thought, you know, this isn't a question, Callan, but I thought you did a really wonderful job at not really placing judgment on some of these actions. Whereas, like, for instance, the brother's father actually, you know, he met this person, worked for this person, and was disgusted by the fact that he was keeping these artifacts in his basement and not giving them to museums, for instance. And again, this isn't so much a question, but maybe I can turn it into one. How do you as the writer keep from imposing kind of that moral judgment on characters who are doing, again, quote unquote, like bad guy things, but not showing that to the reader so that the reader is having those conversations and kind of allowed their own judgments?
I mean, that's a good question. I think I'll just come back to, again, like there's places you can sort of take the moral high ground, you know, but it's a lot easier to do that when you're comfortably established and not worrying about, for instance, your house being repossessed or whatever. So I think all of those sort of philosophical arguments tend to go out the window when you're faced with like these really hard questions of like, how am I going to, you know, continue to live? And the ethical question sort of gets sharpened pretty much. And you make decisions that you might make differently if again, you didn't have that like sort of crushing financial situation.
You're listening to A Conversation with Callan Wink. I'm Lauren Korn. This episode of The Right Question is supported by Chapter One Bookstore in Hamilton, Montana, a literary and community resource for the Bitterroot Valley, providing space to explore, discover, and share passions since 1974. More information can be found at chapteronebookstore.com. So we've talked about the novel's male characters. We've got Thad, we've got Hazen, we've got the Scott, we've talked about this recently deceased father, but there are a couple of female characters in the book who are deeply affecting. The boy's mother, a sort of hippie-ish woman named Sacagawea, and a girl, a young woman, who we know is the Scott's daughter. We're sort of introduced as to her as his daughter. She plays the bagpipes, is a good baker. Callan, talk about crafting these two particular characters. Who did you want them to be in the book? Who did you need them to be to land the narrative and to kind of build the male characters out the way you did?
Yeah, I mean, I think Sacagawea was a character that was in there from the very beginning. And I knew part of kind of the conflict in the novel, she had been gone for much of the boy's kind of childhood, absent at various times, and her sort of sudden reemergence. It just seemed like it was a good sort of point of conflict. Thad especially really resisted her, whereas Hazen was kind of more accepting of her in general. And so that created conflict between the two brothers, as well as between Thad and Sacagawea. So, I think in novels and fiction, it's always a good way to get things going when you have a long absent character sort of return unexpectedly. You know, it's a good generator for narrative. So I think when I was starting it, that's something I knew I wanted. And then the rest of it sort of flowed from there.
And then what about the Scott's daughter? How did she come into play for you? And when did she come into play for you?
She was in most of the really early drafts, but not as fully realized. Definitely. She was always still somewhat of an enigma as it stands now, but is a little more fully fleshed out, I would say. And I guess I didn't want her character to be ever totally like graspable, I guess. You know, who she is and where she's from. And I think part of what she serves is to sort of give Sacagawea like a nice counterpoint in the novel. They have this relationship that's like outside of the brothers. And I think it just gives both of their characters more resonance. Not sure if I answered that one very well, but
I think you did. I think you did. And while we're talking about kind of like the writing craft, I think I read somewhere, I couldn't actually pin it down once I started writing these questions, but I think I read somewhere that this novel, Beartooth, started off as a short story. Is that correct?
Yeah, this one's had like a really long, convoluted sort of path to getting here. Started as a short story a very long time ago. And then I wrote a really long, pretty boring novel that was just like, could never really figure it out. And I put it away for, I don't know, 5 years, probably more, wrote a different novel and then came back to it and just kind of like ruthlessly cut out all of the boring stuff. And then it was a pretty nice novella, like maybe 80, 90 pages. Basically, I had this kind of idea that I would do a collection of novellas. I liked it. I had a couple other novellas, and then publishers were like, we like it, but we can't sell it. So how about you turn this one into a novel? I'm like, I had that already. But anyway, so then I did. I expanded it, and it's still a short novel, but that's the state it's at now. So it kind of, there was a, you know, contraction and a fleshing out, a contraction, and then another fleshing out. That's kind of how it happened.
Was there something in the short story that you just couldn't shake, that you really, you know, grabbed onto and didn't want to kind of just leave to your, you know, the bottom of your desk drawer? Was there something that you really wanted to flesh out?
Yeah, what was that? I always just felt like it was a good premise, you know, and I think when I first started to write the novel, or when I wrote that long kind of boring novel, like I got off the premise and into weird ways, and it sort of fizzled. But putting it away for a really long time, I realized was the right move, because then when I went back to it after, you know, all that time away from it, I was very like, it was like I'd forgotten a lot of it. And it was like seeing it with brand new eyes. And so I was able to pretty quickly be like, oh, that's, that whole section is no good, you know. But I always liked the premise. I liked the characters I had. I had the Scott and the brothers and their mother, you know, all of those were in the short story. And I was like, this is a good, these are some interesting characters. And I thought it deserved a longer treatment than a short story.
Maybe this is a great time for you to read an excerpt from the book. There are, I will say, so many, too many to count, Callan, moments of really, really beautiful writing in this book. So many really striking lines and passages. I've quoted a couple of them back to you. I'm hoping that you could read from pages 9 to 10.
Sure.
We're with the brothers in this passage when they're hiking out. We're at the beginning of the book, so right after they've killed these bears and need to get back to their truck. So I'm hoping you could read that passage.
Refreshed, they hiked, and when the sun fell below the peaks behind them, they kept going through the murky half-light. The shapes of things softened in the gloom, the smell of the pines turning damp as the air cooled. As full dark descended, Hazen led them through a stand of aspen, and they picked their way through the trees. The trunks gathered the moonlight, glowed silver. The aspen leaves had already started to turn, just showing a hint of gold at the edges, and it wouldn't be long before the snow fell up here. Great drifts of it, shape-shifting in the wind, forming ridges like wave troughs on the lee side of the trees. When Thad ran his fingers over the smooth bark of the aspens, it seemed like they exuded warmth, release the heat they'd stored up during the day. He thought aspens could be spooky trees. They liked their own company, grew up close so their leaves could touch one another and their branches could reach together and intertwine like fingers. His father had told him once how the biggest organism in the world was a stand of aspen trees in Canada that stretched for 1,000 miles. When you came upon a grove of aspens, you weren't walking through separate life forms. Aspens are clones. They send up shoots from their shared root mass, so our whole stand of trees might be one plant, the separate trees separate only in the way that a man's foot is separate from his hand. Thad didn't know exactly how to explain it, but he thought that as a group, aspens had a sort of consciousness. This particular stand of trees seemed to stretch forever, but when he finally broke out into a clearing, he could see the overgrown trailhead in the distance, and there was Hazen dumping his pack beside the wheels of their truck.
Separate only in the way that a man's foot is separate from his hand. I love that line. Thad thinks later in the book, as he sort of ponders the existence of God and comes to the conclusion that God was everything. You've written him as thinking, did fingers worship the hand? And I'm curious, Callan, about how you think about spirituality in the same, you know, line of thought that is headed in here. And if Thad's experiences in the natural world then, and his relationship or his belief that everything in the natural world, everything, God is everything, kind of echoes your own philosophies and spiritualities.
Yeah, I'd have to say probably. I mean, I stretching way back to freshman year college philosophy 101 or whatever, so I could be a little shaky on this, but I just remember this professor I had would, you know, sort of set up this thing where you can think about everything as, you know, from a monist, like monism or dualism. Monism being like there is only one thing, and dualism meaning, you know, there's a separate from physical to spiritual or something like that. And I think, you know, when I was younger, the idea that like monism just didn't seem right, you know, raised probably in like a Christian household I was. And so, but now as I get older, it seems more likely that there is one thing and everything is just some part of it, you know?
I like that. How does that guide your stewardship in the natural world, the way you move through the world? How does that guide you?
I mean, it's one of those things that's, it's probably hard to keep it at the forefront of your mind, but when you do stop, or when I do stop to actually think about it in that way, I mean, you know, I make my living not by writing, I'll tell you that. It's fishing. I'm a fishing guide. That's what I do for most of my days in this spring, summer, and fall. And so just kind of being immersed in the outdoors every day. It's sort of weirdly comforting, you know, to think as you sort of ponder mortality like we all do, and knowing that, you know, if everything is one thing, then there's no end really or beginning to anything.
Because you're so close to the waters, you're so close to those ecosystems, I'm curious about how you're seeing them change in light of climate change and certainly the growth in and around the areas where you live. How are things changing, again, because you see them so closely and so intimately?
Yeah, I mean, it's, at least where I live, it's very much a sort of example of a resource being loved to death. I mean, everyone that comes to Montana comes to partake of all of the beautiful things you can do. And it, some of them are suffering from that. I mean, in particular, the Yellowstone River development is the single biggest problem, in my opinion. You know, just water rights. I mean, this is obviously not a new thing in the West. The water is always, always a contentious issue, but more and more, you know, another TV show set in Montana, and it brings another, you know, however many people who need to build a house right on the river. So I don't know where it's all going to go, but I think people who are smarter than me hopefully are trying to think about planning and like a growth in a responsible manner. Hopefully that's something that's being thought of, because it can't just continue unchecked the way it is right now, I don't think, without really sort of the resources suffering. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Callan, is there anything that we haven't covered that you'd like our listeners to know about Beartooth? I mean, we've talked about characters. I mean, we haven't gotten too far down, you know, plot wise, just because I want to, you know, save spoilers. But is there anything we haven't talked about that you'd like our listeners to know?
Oh, man, not really. Hopefully it's like a fairly entertaining, quick read, you know. If anything I can say about this one, I don't feel like it's inflated, you know. It's fairly tight, I would say. So I like that in a novel. Hopefully other readers do as well.
Callan, thank you so much for joining me. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Oh, it was fun. Thank you for having me.
That was Callan Wink, author of the novel Beartooth. You've been listening to The Right Question. To listen to this conversation again, to share it with friends, or to learn more about Callan, head to mtpr.org. This episode was produced by Chris Moyles and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Chris also engineered this episode. The artwork for The Right Question was designed by Molly Russell. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008. And thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.